All right. All right, well, welcome, everybody. My name is Lou Vittorio, and I'm here to give the talk today. I am being self-introduced as I'm already on the committee. I was on the tech committee, and I'm with IBWA, so they said I can self-introduce myself. So before I do that, just remind you that I think it's Michelle's here. She can take, if you're here for CEUs, there's paperwork to fill out to get your CEUs, and also remind myself to put your cell phones on silent, and then we'll get started. So again, I'm supposed to self-introduce myself. So who I am is here. You could read all that of my great accomplishments and what I've done. But who I really am is this. This is really who I am. I see myself on the top left as a geologist and hydrogeologist in command of many things. Society thinks I chase volcanic ash or do some other things geologists do. My friends think I break rocks. That's really true. And what I actually do is drink beer. So, the previous slide has all, we can get to the PDFs as you want. But my name's Lou Vittorio. I'm the principal hydrogeologist with EarthRes. And I've been doing spring water exploration work for about 20 years now. And I've put this presentation together titled Water Source Management in Spring Hole and Borehole Exploration. And I'm going to go through several things with it. The outline is right here. First, we're going to talk about sustainability and global climate change, how it affects us. I have some data on that and how it affects spring sources. I'm going to talk about precipitation and water balance. Site spring identification and monitoring, also transitioning to boreholes, and then the FDA requirements for borehole extraction of spring water. And I'm going to finish up with source water protection analysis and implementation of source water strategies. So the latter parts on this are really related to, if you're not here looking for a new source or, I'm going to go into, to thank you very much. Thank you. Perfect. Appreciate it. I'm going to go into a little bit about how to protect your existing source or maybe how to grow your source. So that's the outline. And if there's any questions during the presentation, feel free to ask me as we go. So this is a laser, but not a... All right. So global climate change, since 1992, Al Gore put out his book, An Earth in the Balance. It's pretty much been in the news, and there's not a week that goes by that there isn't a headline in the newspaper having to deal with global climate change. You'll see several headlines recently, boom, the Earth population. The Time magazine cover from 2000 is a classic about be worried, be very worried, and it shows a polar bear standing on a small, very small and shrinking glacier, I guess you could call that. More recently, we've had doomsday alerts due to over fracking, and we could talk a little about fracking if you have questions on that. And it's a great article because not only is it a doomsday about fracking, but there's a free barbecue guide inside. So while doomsday is coming, we can make sure you get fed well. In California, also that's been in all the news, and we have some data to share on California. And coupled here with the drought headline is also that they get a water roller coaster, which is another interesting dichotomy. More seriously is the historic flooding that just happened in South Carolina. So these things are going on. Is the climate changing? So I'll have some data to share with about that. Here's the storm that just happened in Charleston. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that. The southeastern United States that encompasses Charleston gets about 50 inches of rain a year. And some of these central areas here around Charleston, they got up to 24 inches in 5 days from this storm. And it was described as kind of a water pipe where the clouds were swirling. Or a fire hose, I think I heard it called. It was just a very narrow band of precipitation over 5 days. So they, in a five-day period, they got over half of their precipitation for a year. And again, I'll show you some data what this means. Partly what it means is global change is happening. Global climate change is happening. Whether you believe the causes are man-made or more natural, we could talk about that some more. I'm a geologist. I take a long-term perspective. I will show you data from 1970 on. It seems like things have changed. However, 15,000 years ago, we had 2 miles of ice over our heads, and I'm pretty certain that smokestacks didn't cause the glaciers to melt 15,000 years ago. So there is some debate on whether climate change is real or man-made or is just part of the geologic cycle and has to do with sun radiance, but it's happening. So I will not debate that it's not happening. The Earth has always been warming or cooling. So I'm going to look at some of the data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And this data is available at that website. If you're interested, I can email you a copy of the slideshow. Just drop me an email or give me your card afterwards. And a lot of the links in here will be active. You can go and pull out some of the data for yourself to look at that. The first one is, this is, off the NOAA site, and they have temperature data that dates back to about 1895, and this I pulled up to annual average temperatures since 1895 to the present, which is almost 120 years. And you'll see that since about 1970, temperatures have really been rising, and the overall for the century, temperatures are rising 1.3 degrees Fahrenheit is what the data shows on that. And also you see the swing in the data. There's a lot more extremes happening since 1970. In the precipitation data, I'm going to look at several regions. The NOAA separates the United States, into 9 regions. And I have data on all these regions. I'm going to talk about 2 of them today. I have slides on others, but if you're interested in a region, we can certainly talk about that afterwards. The one I want to focus, several regions I'll focus on today, is the Northeast, the Southeast, and also the West, where the current drought is in California. So here's a table from all the regions that shows the precipitation data since 1895. And as you can see in the Northeast, we get 42 and a half inches of rain. Over the last century, we've gained over 4 inches of rain a year. So it's a change of 10% almost in a century. So one could say it's more global wetting, at least for the United States for the most part, in addition to global warming or climate change. We see in other regions like the Ohio Valley, they've increased 3 inches in this last century. And you can go right down the list. The other notable percent would be the upper Midwest, where it's up to 10%. The Southeast, where Charleston is, not so much, but they already get about 50 inches of rain. So they're already pretty wet where they're located. The West and the Southwest, you see they have, their trend is a little bit flatter. It's negative, but it's not a great deficit in comparison to over 100 years. So there is some less precipitation occurring in the West and the Southwest. This data in the Northeast Pennsylvania looks like this. So some of the things you can recognize in here is again on the left is precipitation in inches on the vertical scale and time frame on the X scale, and this is since 1895, and it shows average annual precipitation per year. So in the Northeast, our average precipitation is 42.5 inches, and this is a plot of the yearly precipitation received throughout the century. So what you can see in the 1930s, remember, I don't know if anybody remembers, but the Dust Bowl in the 1930s is something you probably have read about. Also in the 1960s is a very severe drought. I remember even Bugs Bunny cartoons having things about the drought in them when I was a kid. And then since 1970, what I notice about the precipitation trends is the variability seems to really increase. So we're getting I say deeper droughts and higher precipitation events. We're getting higher intensity storms. And that's what the changes we're seeing across the region that we're looking at. And we'll also do a lot with sinkhole fix and karst geology. And we find that when we get 3-4 inch rain events, we're having sinkhole problems. And we've been seeing more of those types of events into the future. The other thing that you see here is we had a prolonged drought in 1998 to 2000. That was very dry in the region. And then in 2011, we had Hurricane Lee and Irene that deposited significant rainfall in the region and actually led to some problems with sources and flooding and lots of different things. So that's kind of the trends in the Northeast. Again, a lot more variability since 1970, a lot more swings in the climate. In the Southeast, we see that there are still swings in the climate or in the annual precipitation. It doesn't seem to have that much of a difference. I would imagine it's more related to whether they're getting hurricanes or not in the Southeast. And there is a small increase in precipitation over the last century. But there are still, there's highly variable annual precipitation in the Southeast. I don't see that great of an increase in the severity of either the droughts or the wet years. In the West, California gets much less precipitation, and you can see their variability seems to have also changed since 1970. We've had some very large years, very large precipitation event years, and leading us to the present, which is, you can see, the worst drought that they've experienced, at least on record, where they've got less than 10 inches of precipitation out of their average of 22 inches. So it's very severe in California. Other things to note on here is the high precipitation events in the early 1980s and also late 1990s. These were associated with El Nino events, and there, when El Nino, the ocean warming brings precipitation to the coast, they're expecting a El Nino event this year to really abate a lot of the drought. But the problem with that is it comes in, one, it's weather prediction, that's one problem. But the other thing is when El Nino hits, it ends in flooding and landslides. So it's not like you just get some precipitation. Usually it comes in bundles and there's going to be problems associated with it, especially after it's been so dry for so long. So what does this all mean? So the U.S. is receiving more rainfall and recharge, and extremes in weather are increasing. Sources for bottled water should be, I think, fully developed under drought conditions, considering this, because we can have swings in your annual precipitation. So when you develop a source, you really need to consider drought conditions. And I'll mention this a couple other times going through here for that. Peak source use also corresponds in our industry with drier and hotter summer months. And I have there, it's ET's fault. ET is short for evapotranspiration. For instance, in this area of the United States, we generally get precipitation evenly distributed throughout the year. We get about 4 inches a month throughout the year. However, when the growing season starts, the canopy, the trees, take up most of the precipitation. So in the summer months, water levels decline, and in the peak of summer, if you go and if you look at streams, or if you're out in the wintertime and it rains, you'll notice a lot of stream flooding. In the summertime, when you'll get a certain amount of rain, you'll notice the streams aren't flowing as much. That's because the trees are taking up the precipitation. And in the Northeast, it's over 60% of what rain falls is consumed by evapotranspiration and vegetation. So it's a big part of the water budget that's being used up by the trees. I'm not saying you should cut down trees, but it is a large part of the water budget. I guess also the extreme events and drought and flooding may affect sources as well as their TDS and turbidity, maybe fluctuations in water levels, and also chance for bacteria pathways into the source. So the drumbeat of climate change is going to continue, and in this, especially with the drought in California, it's kind of inexplicable if you keep an eye on it, how little a water user bottled water is, yet it's still being drummed up continuously, and there's people always addressing that issue. One of the people that are doing that is Bottled Water Matters. If you've been to the website, you can go there and you can see just how little of the water is used from the water cycle, which I will get to, for bottled water. Other places to get data are industry groups like the United States Geological Survey and some regional water authorities. They can be clearinghouses and have much useful information and statistics on water uses. And as I said, water use for bottled water is insignificant compared to agricultural, industrial, and potable and recreational uses. But at your source, you still have to be sustainable. So you're going to have a source, you want it to be sustainable, regardless of what's going on out there. You need to know what's happening at a drought at your site. So I'll talk a little bit about the water budget. Is anybody here familiar with precipitation, water balance? I mean, I could go through this very quickly. Basically, water is a renewable resource, and it is in the water cycle. Water is evaporated from the oceans and from lakes, is deposited as rainfall onto the ground surface, seeps into the ground as groundwater, overland flow as surface water, may be stored in freshwater lakes, and then it makes its way back to the rivers and makes its way back to the ocean, and then the process repeats itself. So in areas where we have great climate records and we know the average annual precipitation, we're pretty sure that the water cycle is going to continue to occur. And even though some years we have more drought or higher rainfall events, the water cycle is continuous. The distribution of water in the earth, you've probably seen this graphic before from the USGS, but 96% of all water is in the oceans, and only 2.5% of the water on the earth is freshwater. And of that 2.5%, if you go from left to right, 68% of that water is held in glaciers and ice caps, and 30% of it is in groundwater, and 1.3% is in surface water and other freshwater. So it's a very small part of the budget that we're looking at. The water on the Earth's surface and in the water budget is vast. So water is renewable, and on average in the U.S., say in the eastern U.S., we get about 40 inches a year. The water, once it rains, part of it, it runs off the ground, part of it recharges into the ground. You get bedrock storage in the water-bearing zones in the rock and fractures. We really don't have underground rivers unless you're in some limestone terrains where you can have underground, but there's a misconception that water flows in underground rivers. It flows in the porosity of the rock and in fractures. In areas where glaciers are, the glaciers act as a sponge, and they can store the water for you and also increase recharge and also increase discharge at times, or at least buffer the amount that comes in and out of the system, and it acts for infiltration. So it's conservative to consider your surface water basin as what your groundwater basin is. So what is a surface water basin? We define that by the water drop method. If you have a topographic map and rain falls on this mountain, this is the dividing line of the basin, whereas rainfall that falls on the other side of this ridge will fall out of your basin. Rainfall that falls on this side, it comes into your basin. All water, all fresh water that we're looking at originated as precipitation rainfall. So in your basin, if your spring's down here with the X, how much water can you be thought to receive in your basin? It really depends on how big your basin is. How much rainfall you get over your basin will determine how much water will be available at your spring. And how to quickly do that, we use a precipitation amount of 42 inches a year, and we assume about 10 inches of that is recharge. So of all the 42 inches of rain, 10 inches of that water will seep into the ground and form groundwater and move down through the basin and either come out as springs or be extracted through wells. 32 inches of that water is going to be evaporated by the trees and or run off in the streams. So given a 1 square mile basin, you could have a spring of 331 gallons a minute. If you go through the math here, I won't take you through the math. That would be at the end of the basin based upon 10 inches of recharge over a basin, a 1 square mile basin. But that means, that number means that I'm assuming all that water is coming out at my spring, and that's just not the case. And also, this is the 1 mile large basin for your spring. Actual basin for this spring would be probably the upgrading areas in this, so it'll be a much smaller area. But in general, over a square mile, 331 gallons a minute with 10 inches a year recharge would equal 330 gallons a minute of water out of the basin. So considering that, when you look at your site, what is sustainable? And you really want to look at drought base flows. So if you have a spring, again, I'll mention this again, you want to permit your spring to the drought base flows. I guess I can't say that enough. I get a lot of calls, and I know here you get calls in May, I have a great spring, come look at my spring. I have a great, you know, I can make a lot of money. I say, well, let's look at it in September. Let's look at it in August. What's it doing this year? I want to see what it's flowing in September and August. I want to know that because that's when bottled water sales are the highest in the hot summer months and into the fall. So what does it all mean? You want to evaluate the hydrogeology and sustainable yield. And as I just said, it's a cruel trick of Mother Nature that when you need the water the most, it's the driest. And but if you permit your source based upon when it's driest, you always have the water as advertised. So what do? So you've identified a new spring source, and you get the phone call. What do you do next? How do you want to go about it? So a little bit I want to talk about spring types. These are cross-sectional diagrams that are if you want to look at what we call the aquifer. So this is the ground surface on the top, and this is going with depth, and it's kind of a slice, kind of like a slice of pie looking through the earth. And this represents, say, a unit of sandstone where you get rainfall recharge onto the top, rainfall seeps in, forms a water. The water table surface where the groundwater starts, and the water flows downhill, and at the base of this hill you'll find a spring, and that's basically where the groundwater surface intercepts the land surface and the water emerges as a spring. That's one example of a spring. Another example is in this area where you have a hill and you have a sandstone aquifer sitting on top of, say, a shale aquifer, an impervious rock. A rainfall falls onto the top of the spring, groundwater table fills up, and then it tips over, and at this contact between the impervious spring surface and the sandstone, you'll have a spring forming. Other examples are in layer cake geology, where you'll have an impervious layer, but here you have a pervious layer where its rainfall is falling on this area. Water will come down through the aquifer. It may hit a fault or a fracture or some other discontinuity in the earth and emerge at the ground surface as a spring. It's another spring type. The example on the bottom is in karst geology, where carbonate terrain, limestone, you hear Florida quite a bit where there's sinkholes that are in the news. They swallow Porsche dealerships in the past, and unfortunately, several years ago, a gentleman was killed in his bedroom while sleeping in Florida. Basically, it's karst geology where the calcium carbonate rock is dissolved by acid rain, and actually it's been happening for millennium. And in that case, you can have cavernous flow or underground rivers. And in this case, where rainfall comes onto the ground surface, you have the caverns filling up to a level, and down here at this lower elevation, you'll have a spring popping out because it has water head behind it pushing the spring out. So most of the springs we deal with in the Northeast, although there are carbonate springs, are sandstone-type springs. In Florida, I don't think you have a choice but to have a carbonate spring. Other springs show, again, I'm looking at cross sections and just showing some examples of springs. And you could go online at this site and you could look at different examples of springs and spring types. One of the other examples here is, again, you have a permeable rock layer, you have rainfall in this area, and you'll have some sort of fault, and at that discontinuity, you'll have a spring forming. And this here, a lot of the springs in this area have joints and fractures in the rock, and where the fractures may intersect the ground surface, you could get a spring due to recharge on the mountain. All right, here's a glacial spring. Where the overlying, these are silts, and there's a sand layer here that has the aquifer in it, and as you comes down to the low area, a spring is formed in the earth through a natural breach, and here's an example of tapping that spring through either a spring box or various boreholes to tap into the aquifer before it emerges at the spring. So how do you determine if this opportunity is real? Somebody's called you with a spring. We determine what type of spring it is. How can you determine if it's a real opportunity? Well, one, you need to evaluate several things. You want to look at the geology. You want to look at the water quality. You want to look at what's happening in the watershed. And I've listed several things here, such as stream designations, zonings, and also to know if there's any local watershed protection groups that may be opposed to extraction of spring water. The geology of the area, this is quite a handy tool. Now, if you go to this link, now this is maybe something I do because I'm a geologist, but you can go to this link and on Google, you can get the geology for any state in a Google Earth file. So you just click on the link, download it, click on it, and you go to your state, and you can have all the geology for your state, and it has all 50 states in there that you can just bring in and look at the geology. And this is a case I just pulled in from where we're at. Here's where we're sitting today. And to the east of us, there's various different geologies. You click on it. Here's one example of a Newark Group sandstone, which is fairly typical in the area up through Pennsylvania, that we would look for springs in a sandstone aquifer. So one of the things I would do when I first analyze a site is I go to the maps and say, what is the unit that the spring is located in? I would then go to published literature from the USGS to see or the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection to see what the water quality is in that type of rock. Different types of rock, if you remember from back in school, are igneous, metamorphic, and sandstone. I've had springs in mostly metamorphic and sandstone type environments that have also been enhanced, or some of those traps that I showed for spring forming were formed by igneous formations. They may form a barrier to water flow, causing a spring. So, all right. I want to look at the water quality, do initial screening. Has anybody used National Testing Labs? They have a water check. It's $200-$300, and you can get a fairly extensive list. So if you're evaluating a spring for the first time, you don't want to do the $2,500 list of everything. You want to just do a quick and dirty list. They can do it. They'll send you the kits. You'll get a good analysis of what's in the water. And you'll look at basic cations and anions of the water and analyze some of the wells in the area if you can for the same parameters. Here's an example of the water quality comparison. These are water quality charts where I plot on here cations and anions, and when I say that, calcium, sodium, magnesium, sulfate, bicarbonate. And in this example, the springs and the boreholes plot very, very close to each other. And that's what you want to see, and we'll get into that a little bit more as I talk about the standard of identity for springs. All right, so you can also do an expanded list and look for other items that are that could be in your watershed based upon your research. If there's any contamination, hopefully you found a watershed that has a large protected watershed area. We look at areas that might have state game lands or state forests in the uphill areas that you know will not be developed. Measure spring rate. I think one of the things that you should do if you have a site is measure your spring rate early and measure it often. And you should measure it in normal precipitation years. And again, here's the drought word. You should know what your spring is going to flow in a drought condition. And some of the ways to do that are with weirs and flumes. I have some pictures of these that we can show you. This is a V-notch weir that you can install in your spring. The angle of that notch and the height of water above that notch gives you how much water is flowing through it. And here's an example of one that's installed. We have a V-notch weir. You see water pouring through this. And behind it, we have a stilling well that has a water level recording device in it. And so I calibrate the height of that water is equal to the height of water over the weir. And so it's simple. So you can install something like this, or if it's close enough to you, get measurements. But really, during the dry period, if you have a spring, you want to know what its flow rate is. Partial flume is another device that we use to measure stream flow or spring flow. This in this area is a stilling well where we'll put what's called a pressure transducer, which is just basically a electronic water level recording device. Water has a pressure to it. The more water you have in a well, the higher the pressure. So we put this device at the bottom, and it'll measure the height of water above it and the change of it. You could log it every minute, every second, every day. So what that looks like in the field is something like this. So here's a flume. There's a spring upgrading of this. And we made sure that we funneled all the spring water through the flume with the wing walls. And in the flume, there's a pressure transducer recording the level that's directly related to flow rate. Also, if there's streams in the areas, you want to measure surface water channel flow in the streams and look online. There's typically USGS has gauging stations nearby that can tell you. And there's a great, and across the nation, there's a great program called Stream Stats where you can actually go and click on a link and it'll tell you how much water is flowing in a stream or is expected to flow in a stream. And you could use that to back up your calculations. You want to look at area well information, too, from environmental database reports and look to the USGS and look to state environmental agencies and driller logs. You can find data. Now we can do a lot of work from the desktop. We can find a lot of data online to without going out and collecting data. We can first do a good desktop database search with the Internet and what's online information from the regulatory agencies. You want to look at your stream designations. Basically, the higher the designation of a stream, a lot of times the harder it is to permit the water. If you have a stream that's very exceptional value, it's going to be very difficult to extract a lot of water if the water is impacting the flow of the stream. So you're going to want to know what your stream designations are in your study. Wetlands. Springs are usually associated with wetlands. So when you're taking water from a spring, you could have an effect on the nearby wetland. So you're going to need to do monitoring of the wetlands during the spring extraction tests. And here's an example of a spring network in a wetland network also. Zoning, land development. If you're doing it, where you're located, this is something I'll go through very quickly, but you need to know what your property is zoned for. You need to be able to know if there's water extraction is allowed and what the specific language is in there, because you may have to rezone. And if you have to rezone and there's opposition groups, it can be very difficult. We've spent time at meetings, at nights, going through this process, and there is a lot of passion against bottled water. It really is. Setbacks. So this all goes into the zoning. You should really control a lot of the recharge area, or we'll go into that a little bit. You should control the area around the spring so you have control on its quality. And you can meet the setbacks set by the township or the local municipality for you. Again, I mentioned local opposition groups. Is anybody have opposition on their projects now, ongoing? No? That's good news then. Not that you want to tell. So where do you place the borehole? So this, we're going to get into the FAA definition of why you want a borehole and where you want to place it in relation to your spring. Basically, you want to intercept the spring at depth, and you want to intercept the geologic feature that causes a spring, and typically you want to have it up gradient of the spring. You want to get it at a higher region or higher elevation than your spring. And you'd like to, as I said, control the recharge area. So here are the examples that I showed you before. If this is the spring, you would likely want to go uphill and put a borehole in this area and intercept the water before it gets to the spring. In the glacial scenario, the same thing. You want to go up gradient of your spring or uphill from your spring and put in a borehole to intercept it. And the same with in joints and fractures in a sandstone or granite rock. You're going to do the same thing. Typically, you want to be up gradient of your spring in order to tap into it before it comes to the ground surface. So how do you site that? We'll do geological studies, fracture trace analysis, we'll use aerial photography, geophysical surveys, and we'll also put in test boreholes. So what some of that looks like, here's a site. It's actually a very large spring in Williamsburg, Pennsylvania, that forms along a fault line here. This is the fault, and the spring is right at this point. What this looks like on the geologic map, it tells you just the different geologic units. What it looks like on what we call LIDAR. Has anybody looked at LIDAR maps before? They're kind of terrain maps. It's a very, very useful tool that's provided for us by the government in several states. It basically is looking at the ground surface without vegetation. So it kind of looks like the moon when you look at it. It strips the vegetation away from you. And the spring in question forms along this fault, and you can see this little erosion rill right here. This is actually where the spring comes out at that site. And what that looks like in real life here is the spring catchment. It comes out, so the hill was up this way, and you can see the spring flowing here. And this is something we could identify with aerial photographs. And I hit the end button, so I shouldn't do that. Bear with me. So this is what the spring looks like. In this case, this spring makes about 3,000 gallons a minute. It's a very large spring. Here is a spring that was in glacial topography where we had a spring here, and when we drilled the borehole, we found a large fracture at depth, about 150 to 200 gallons a minute. And so how did we know that the spring was connected, and how did we know where to put the borehole into the spring? And in this instance, we looked at the LIDAR, and we saw also there was a large fracture that was going up the spring valley, and we saw that fracture. And when we looked to do our drilling of the borehole, we used electrical resistivity. Basically, we go out with a bunch of electrodes and pump electricity into the ground, and the theory is that fractures flowing with water conduct more electricity than solid rock that doesn't have any fractures of water in it. So we went out, we did an electrical resistivity survey, and found a depth where current was flowing in the surface. So it's kind of, it's more of a high-tech water witching, if you want to call it that. So we found out where the fracture was, where the water was flowing into it, and we went back out and we put the borehole into that location. That's when we found the water. So that was one technique to do that, to explore and find the spring. Once you found it, we installed the borehole, and boreholes need to be properly constructed with a pad on the top, have a casing seal to put the pump down below, and depending on the type of aquifer you're in, you may have an open hole boring, or you may have to put a sand pack between the boring and the inside of the well. And then you put your pump down the well, and you have a sanitary seal up top for pumping the groundwater. So how do you know if you're successful in doing this? We evaluate the fact that we put in the borehole, that we had sufficient yield. We do pumping tests on this. We'll put a pump in the well, and we'll pump the well. Typically, we have to pump it for 72 hours to determine if the well can yield sufficient water that we would want to use. We also check the water quality through a certified laboratory, and at this point when we're doing this, we usually do a full suite of analysis. We call it new source sampling parameters. We also sample and check for bacteria and what's called a microparticulate analysis, which is basically a filter that you run several gallons a minute through for a portion of the test to see if it's picking up any pollen or rotifer eggs or any other microbiological contaminants that might be in there that show impact to surface water. And then we determine if it meets FDA requirements and state requirements. And so here's the FDA regulatory requirements for extraction of spring water through a borehole. And the main things that you need to have is there has to be a hydraulic link between the borehole and the spring. We do this through pumping tests. We'll pump the borehole, and if there's a physical effect on the spring, so the spring's flowing at 100 gallons a minute, we pump a borehole at 100 gallons a minute. If the spring's flow decreases to 90 gallons a minute, we have a hydraulic link. We have a physical connection between the two. The other one is we have to have the water must flow, continue to flow to the ground surface. And the other important part, I've showed you some of these, is the water must be the same chemical and physical properties. So how we do that is through the water quality sampling. And in this case, we've done what's called stiff plots, where we take the spring water and we take the borehole water. We take samples from both, and the shapes of those, as far as how they form on the diagram of the cation-anion plots, tells me that the water quality is the same. On the Piper plot, where we plot the calcium, the sodium, the bicarbonate, and the sulfate, and the chloride, the waters also overlap, telling me that they're the same type of water. And we also do a Scholler plot that'll show that the water is the same. So in the case where we have a borehole intercepting a spring, we have physical connection, we have chemical connection, we can demonstrate that through what's called the standard of identity, FDA, that what we pull out of the borehole is indeed spring water, per the FDA definition. Yes?
Assuming everything went right the first time, realizing there's so many variables, but ballpark price range to develop a spring with what you just stated, if everything worked.
It depends where you're at, the state regulations, but it's usually several hundred thousand dollars for all the drilling and testing and surveys and permitting infrastructure that you need to put in once you get your permits. And you're going to need to put in some roads, a silo, you know, disinfection equipment. It's a fairly large investment. In some areas where permitting isn't as extensive, yes.
How much water must be left pouring out of the spring when you catch water?
Yes, the amount of water, it depends where you are. In Pennsylvania, they're very strict about what we call pass-by. So when we look at a spring, I try to affect less than 10% of it. So I want to. It's where threading the needle is on the borehole. We want to have the borehole far enough away from the spring that we have an effect on it, but that we don't affect it significantly. And it's a difficult task at times. It takes some drilling and redrilling of wells. In Pennsylvania, the Susquehanna River Basin Commission has very strict requirements on pass by, what you can take, and what you have to leave going by in the stream. The larger your watershed, the easier it is. You know, if your spring is next to the segment of a very large stream, then your spring flow is insignificant compared to the stream. If your spring's next to a very small stream, then your spring flow is higher in percentage-wise. So it really depends upon the environment of your spring.
Additional question. On which calculation do you base that? On the dry water flow?
I look to do it on the dry water flow because that'll be your limiting factors. Now, again, we're dealing with an agency that's doing a sliding factor now, where they do it monthly, so we have to calculate it monthly. But if you're looking to develop a source, you want to know what that flow rate is in the dry time and what your pass-by rate or what you have to leave behind in the dry time, because that could be a deal killer. And we've looked at sites where that is the deal killer. You say this spring might make 70 gallons a minute. The stream going by, it only makes 20 gallons a minute. And if you take half of that, you're taking a lot of the spring stream flow. So, yeah. Yes.
How close do you think the spring
could go? We've been between 100 and 1,000 feet, and the ones that we've done over the last 20 years, and it really depends on the geology, but it can't be half a mile away typically. You can leapfrog them depending on the geology, but typically they're fairly close, and they should be on your same property and in the same watershed. And that's where, you know, I get calls where the spring is located right on the property line, and I need to go up gradient of that and to put in a borehole, and you just don't have a control of the recharge area. But so several hundred to 1,000 feet. So that's that. Now, you may not want to develop a new source. And by the way, this source is in, if you've ever been up to Lititz, Pennsylvania, this is a huge spring that forms in that town. It's a very nice park. There's also Wilbur Chocolates there. If you go there, you want to go to Wilbur Chocolates. But it's a really nice park. It's a big carbonate spring. I imagine in the past it was used, but if you go up there, there's a water authority right behind the spring, and there's several production wells that they use for public supply. So you have a spring and you want to look at long-term viability of the spring, and we've talked about some of the global climate change and things you're going to want to look at your spring, what's happening at your spring. So I'm going to go through delineating your recharge area, which we talked about a little bit, identify and prioritize all threats of contaminant sources in your spring, so delineation of wellhead protection zones, enhanced monitoring and sampling, looking at erosion and sedimentation evaluation, and then choosing implementation and management strategies to protect your water. The first one is delineating your watershed. I went through the water drop method with you before. Whereas, how big is your watershed? Where is all the water contributing to your watershed coming from? And you may already have that information. You can simply, a lot of this you can download the GIS databases. You can download watersheds and see where your spring is. You can get a map of it and look at what is in your watershed. You can also delineate yourself by getting a topographic map and basically drawing a line around the ridges around your spring. identify in that zone, you're going to want to identify and prioritize all potential contaminant sources. Anybody buy property, somebody's done a phase one environmental assessment. If you buy a property, basically it's, and I'll show you a map from that. It's a public database search that you could use, and there's several internet sites that you can go to get that kind of environmental data. So when you're looking at a spring site, you want to know what's around your spring site, and you can get online and order up some data. Some of these are free. Some are up to about $200, but all the services are pretty good. You want to look at your zoning and land use maps, where you're at. You don't want a spring that the property next door to you is industrially zoned or industrially zoned for a use that that may be detrimental to your spring. In some cases, if your site's industrially zoned, it's actually good for spring water extraction. I've seen that because that's spring water extraction may fall under industrial use. But you'll certainly want to look at what the surrounding land use is. EPA provides some free online tools to assess potential impacts to springs, and I have a link there for that. I think they call it surfing your watershed. They call that, so you can get online and actually surf your watershed. Very clever. When you look at some of those sites, they'll give you a map. Say if your spring's in the middle, they'll give you a radius map and give you sites of concern that may be around your spring that you may want to know about, including gas stations, industrial sites, treatment plants, pipelines, wetlands, landfills, and of course if there's any oil and gas drilling activity going on. So one of the source water protection areas is a mapping exercise. Map your site, know what's around you, and know what your potential threats are.
So how would you determine if those are risks?
So in looking at in a lot of the sites, we look at the risks, look at your watershed, and then they'll identify in the database reports we get, it'll identify if they're upgrading of you or downgrading of you in elevation. So we'll look at that. And if you see a landfill site that might be a risk, then I would go and do a file review or find out more information on that. So I'd kind of triage them in that order and then go evaluate them to see if they're risks. Some of them, if it's a leaking underground tank, gas station, you might find that the cleanup was completed 20 years ago, and there's clean records in the file. Then from that data and knowing your watershed, I would delineate wellhead protection zones and implement site controls. So on site, you want to control directly what's around your spring. You really don't want anything within 400 feet of your spring. That's an arbitrary number, but it's one I've seen in the literature. So if you can limit all the activities around your borehole in spring, it's a good idea. And then you want to protect as much as you can the zones of recharge and the contribution and capture for your springs. And they're different, and I'll go into them real quickly. So this is a pumping borehole. This is a cube of the ground surface. Here's a well or a borehole in our industry that is pumping groundwater out of the borehole. And what happens here is you get a cone of depression that forms around the borehole in the groundwater. And on this side, it's another, you can kind of see where the cone of depression is larger here. And so when you're pumping an area, that's considered your capture zone. So water falling in those areas and in upgrading areas is a little bit more detailed hydro definition, but you want to know what your contribution and capture zone is from your borehole. And you can determine that through your pumping test when you do your source to see how far does your cone of depression extend. This publication, these graphics actually come from this publication. And if I haven't bored you to death already and you don't want to ever become a hydrogeologist, then don't read this. But if you're going to read one publication on hydrogeology, I would read this one. It has great graphics. Anybody we hire entry level, I give them this. I say read this first. It's a very good document. And so it's by Ralph Heath, and it's a very good document. So if you want to learn a little bit about all the mumbo jumbo I was spouting, you could read this, and it's a very good document. So once you know your contributing area and the sources of contamination that are in the area, you may want to consider some enhanced monitoring and sampling. You know, evaluating how your source responds to seasonal rain events and determining if potential contaminants are coming onto your site, you may want to put in what we call sentinel wells or do some enhanced monitoring of your water source as you go in time. If there, you found a threat, put in a well towards the edge of your property and sample it fairly routinely, monthly to see if there's any increase in TDS or any of the parameters that you determine through your the prior part of this process. Coastal waters may be susceptible to sea level rise and seasonal aquifer overuse. Installation of sentinel wells are there also. My wife and I have vacationed in Cape May this year, New Jersey. Anybody familiar with Cape May, New Jersey? But they have, down by the fire tower in the one point, they actually have a former phosphate plant, and it's now a desalinization plant. So their aquifer is susceptible to saltwater intrusion from the ocean. And it's highly a seasonal use. So people go to the shore in droves in the summertime. So the population swells exponentially almost, it seems, if you go down there in the summertime. So what they do is they pump groundwater throughout the year. They treat and desalinate water throughout the year and pump it back into the aquifer in the winter months so that in the summertime comes and there is the population explodes and the water uses explodes that they can keep enough supply for the residents and the vacationers without having seawater encroach on their aquifer. And in those cases, they certainly have sentinel wells to measure, say, TDS on the outskirts of their aquifer to make sure they're not drawing down the aquifer too much to have saltwater encroach into it. Erosion and sedimentation evaluation. One of the things I've talked about with increased storm events, you may want to just drive around your site during a rainstorm and look at what's happening to the stormwater. Have any of the improvements you've done on site, does the stormwater need to get off site faster? Is there anybody upgrading of you that's built and has now stormwater coming onto your site? These are things you could look around again during a rain event. It's certainly helpful to go out and drive around and see what's happening, especially when you're getting rain. You know, are the storm drains and culverts effective in controlling storm flow? Is there runoff from upgrading sites? And also, if your improvements are sufficient to drain stormwater. So what can you do? You do all these studies. So what can you do to implement some protection strategies at your site? So you've done the studies, you've done the mapping, you've looked at potential contaminant sources, you've considered enhanced monitoring. So here are some things that you might want to do at your site to help improve it if you think you have a problem. And one of them is site improvements. We talked about the wellhead protection zone. You're going to want to limit activities in or around your borehole or spring. So if you have facilities on site, you might want to move them out of there. You might want to consider some other things to improve your site. Developing a program of enhanced monitoring and sampling for fair warning. If you find that there's threats from off-site contaminants, you may want to put in a monitoring well. You may want to do full-time TDS monitoring of your source. And there's some other things that we can talk about afterwards if you have any questions. Developing an outreach and education program. I think this is an important thing to get out there. And again, as the industry IBWA, there's a lot of tools available on the websites. And it's good to get out so people understand your business and know what you are doing and that you are actually a steward of the site. You want to protect the site because you certainly don't want to deplete the water resources. Other thing that's very handy, and I think somebody mentioned this, we were talking yesterday about getting on a local watershed advisory or implementing a program to get out into the community and have signage. And I have one of the other ones as signage. But if you get in the local watershed advisory committee, you can be involved when industry is coming to town. You'll know it. Just get involved with your local officials so you know what change is coming to your community. It's always a good strategy to just be involved to know what is going on. And if there is something going on, you should engage the public officials about it. You may have found when you did your study that there was a Superfund site near your spring, and you're concerned about it. Engage the local officials about that. Talking to people about making sure things stay clean is always received well. Developing a local road signage program. We've looked at this in different areas, and on public roads, it's hard to get. I shouldn't say, but on state roads, you may see signs out. You drive around, you see wellhead protection area. A lot of those apply to public water supply systems, community supply systems. So it's hard for, in my experience, bottled waters in the areas I work in to be able to get the state government to help you put signs up on a road to protect your water source. However, your water source a lot of times is within a larger watershed, and there may be already signage on the roads in the watershed that you have your source in. The local municipality, on the other hand, may be willing to have a local road signage program where you can put up signs to warn people, hey, watershed area. You've seen seen fish on storm drains. Anybody see that? No dumping, no spilling. So things like that are something that certainly can do protection strategies for your watershed. The other thing is, once you identify where the contaminants are, you can also purchase additional properties. It's easy, right? You just go out, just buy properties. But it is certainly something that some of our clients have done and have looked at, especially in crucial areas of the watershed where you want to have control of the recharge. And then from all this data, you want to develop contingency plans. What happens in case of a spill or a leak? What are you going to do? Say your sentinel well starts showing some contamination. What are you going to do about it? So developing those contingency plans now in case something happens is certainly desirable. So, and I think with that, that's all I have for you today. I don't have any questions, or be happy to entertain them at this point. No questions?
Jokingly, how soon can you be at my place?
Oh.